Welcome to Today's Issues, offering a Christian response to the issues of the day. Here's your host, Tim Wildman, President of the American Family Association.
Well, no, the announcer got it wrong again. This is not Tim Wildman, this is Ed Vitagliano sitting in for Tim Wildman, who is in D.C. up for the inauguration of a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity, and he's going to see the new president sworn in. As I said, Ed Vitagliano, I'm joined in studio by Fred Jackson, news director for American Family News and One News Now, and Abe Hamilton, public policy analyst and general counsel for AFA. Good morning, gentlemen.
Good morning. Good to be with you on this, 25 hours before.
Yes. This is bizarro world. We're tomorrow morning. Well, I guess it'll be noon Eastern time.
11 our time.
11 our time. We will see Donald Trump sworn in as the 45th president of the United States. I was on this morning looking at on the Drudge Report. They had, you know, Matt Drudge, you know, likes to rub things in, but had a link to a story. It might have been from Media Research Center. I'm not sure. But anyway, they were showing all the people, all the leftists in the media who mocked Trump's announcement that he was running for president. I mean, it's pretty embarrassing how all these smart people didn't see it coming. I don't know anybody who really did. But
did you say smart?
Well, yeah, these people are smart. That doesn't mean they're wise.
Well, let's be real honest about it. There were bunches of conservatives who also—
Oh, I didn't think it.
Who's no, also
I
laughed.
Yeah.
You know, said, really? Donald Trump with that hair? You know, apprentice, all of this sort of thing. You know, he's just doing this for publicity. That's all he's doing it for.
Right.
You know, that's what was being said in liberal and conservative circles.
Yeah, and I'll admit, several times during the primary season, after Trump had announced that he was running for president, he would step in it. I guess I can say that. He would stumble, probably a better way of putting it. He would say something just completely off the wall, and I would think, he's done. He's toast. He won't come back from that. You know the John McCain thing?
Oh, yeah.
When he said, well, he's a hero, but he's a hero because he got caught. I prefer heroes who don't get caught, and just so many things. Even the statement about Mexicans coming across, the way he worded it, I thought, he's toast. He just won't bounce back. And so I was wrong countless times.
It's interesting. You know, what did it for me when I started to believe that maybe his candidacy is serious is when I started to see the crowds last summer, when I started to see the crowds showing up by the thousands, I started to realize I had misread what was going on in this country.
Right.
You know, when you the first debates kind of rough, but then, you know, he started to win some of these debates and he was getting cheered on, but it was the rallies that did it for me.
I think that's exactly right.
You know, thousands of people trying to get in, waiting hours for him to come. What is he saying that is resonating with so many people? And that just continued. I mean, this man was doing 4 to 5 rallies a day. He was flying all over the place, and they were waiting for him, cheering him on. And then, of course, we got into the primaries, and oh, my goodness. I mean, this is serious.
Well, like Tim Wildman, who, you know, the president and the host of this show on normal days, he would always say, Abe, this guy's like, the Energizer Bunny has nothing on Donald Trump. He would do 3, 4, sometimes 5 of these a day.
Yeah.
And the crowds were enormous. They were enthusiastic. I guess it's easy when if you approach politics from a cerebral standpoint. In other words, you read what's going on, you watch the experts. It really is sometimes hard to miss the undercurrent, and here's another thing that I think is important here. while Hillary Clinton was drawing very small crowds, mm-hmm. sometimes embarrassingly mm-hmm. small crowds,
you wouldn't
Bernie
have heard that from the
Sanders
media.
Was drawing on the other side, mm-hmm. was drawing big crowds mm-hmm. Of people from the what I would consider the far left, a lot of young people. There is something going on in this country, and it's not settled yet.
Oh, well, no. And I think that's something that was going on during the campaign election season has rolled over into now, where you have some people who are rejoicing at Friday's appearance.
Right.
Where others are literally in mourning.
Yes.
And there are very few, although there's some, but it appears at least very few who are in the middle. You're either in a lot of people's minds, you're either on one end of the spectrum or the other, with very few being in the middle, as to how the media would carry it. But I think there are a lot more people in that middle than the media is actually revealing, you know, because you have, you know, the people who want to protest the inauguration and people that, you know, calling for anarchy and all this other type of stuff. They just happen to be vocal.
Right.
But I don't think they're accurate representatives of the true essence of where our country is right now.
And I would say this, that Fred, even though this country is clearly polarized to some degree, I think Abe also might be onto something. There may be the largest percentage in the middle who just want this country to get fixed.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. There's, you know, economic problems. The middle class mm-hmm. is under tremendous pressure. We do have growing poverty, it appears, a growing underclass, including many people who not only aren't employed but have given up. I mean, there really are a lot of people who are saying to Washington, look, we just want it fixed. That's why there were a lot of people who were Bernie Sanders fans and a lot of people who were Donald Trump fans, a total political neophyte, okay, just not a political person at all. We think you can fix what's going on.
It's the story of the non-politician. That's what it is.
Yeah.
When you think back when the Republican debates were starting, how many were there, 15, 16 on that stage?
It might have been 17.
17 on that stage.
Yeah.
And you looked at all of those politicians. Now, there were a few others that were on that stage that may outside of maybe the formal political realm.
Carly Fiorina, Ben Carson.
Yeah. But when you looked at that stage, and you know, if you were a betting man, as Brother Don has been wont to say many times, and you looked at Jeb Bush, and you looked at Ted Cruz, and you looked at Marco Rubio.
Low energy.
You looked at Mike Huckabee, and all those people. He's going to get it.
Right.
Yeah. You know, that's the way it went. We were stuck in that traditional thinking.
Yes.
And then along comes, and it's fascinating. There's a story unfolding in New York at LaGuardia right at this moment. I think it's LaGuardia. But it's, and they were making mention of this, the Donald Trump story. If the Lord tarries, it's going to be a fascinating piece of history. Here's a kid from Queens who looks downtown Manhattan where all the uppy-ups are.
Right.
Now, he's pretty well off. He gets $1 million loan, I think, from his dad.
Yeah.
This morning, he left.
Who doesn't get $1 million loan from their dad?
What's unusual about that?
Yeah.
But this morning, he left Trump Towers. Whatever, how high that is. He went down. Here is this motorcade waiting to take him out to the airport, and we're just watching this. It may be a bit of a sad day for Donald Trump because he doesn't get to ride on the Trump plane anymore.
Right.
Because this morning, it's a government jet. It's not Air Force One, but it's a government jet, a 757. Now, he flies around in his own 757. I have to assume the government 757 isn't quite as nice as his airplane. But he's getting on that to fly down to Washington, D.C. with under 25 hours now. He'll be sworn in as President of the United States. And there are still many people in this – they just cannot fathom this. I was just listening to a first news conference with Sean Spicer.
Right.
His director of communications.
Press secretary.
Yeah. One of the questions asked by one of the reporters, and this is going to be so typical, don't you think it's a conflict of interest that Donald Trump is going to lay his head on the bed tonight in a hotel room that he owns? Doesn't this speak to the conflict of interest that he's been accused of? He can't get away from his own businesses. And Spicer's, look, it's his hotel. What's wrong with him staying in his own hotel? Because Vice President-elect Pence was out a little bit earlier this morning, and he was letting the public know, you know, the transition team gets taxpayers' money to do their work.
Right.
He says, we're sending a check back for 20% of what we didn't spend. We're putting that back in taxpayers' coffers. And he was saying, that's the way Donald Trump's going to work. So I'm assuming that he's not going to charge himself to stay at the Trump Hotel, which is not far from the White House. They just opened it several months ago. But the reporter, isn't this going to the conflict of interest? And Spicer said, he's going to spend the night in his own hotel. What's the problem here? This is going to be the Donald Trump story that you're going to see over and over again.
Well, and Abe, unfortunately, it's going to be what we're going to have to deal with on a regular basis. You know, it's I guess it's probably always been true, but because of the polarization in this country, and by polarization, I mean we're no longer in the day where you have Republicans and Democrats who disagree about the size of the welfare program or, you know, how many ships are we going to build in our Navy, and then they go off and are friends again. We are talking about people who seem to occupy two completely different worlds in terms of ideology or worldview. But this election did not settle any of that. So what we are going to have to, and I've got to say, after the euphoria of thinking we will not have a secular progressive in the White House, having seen what's happened since Election Day, I think it's going to be ugly in terms of the media. We're already seeing that in the way they're going after Trump and vice versa. Don't want to make this just one-sided. But then vilifying, the hostility, the hatred from the left towards Donald Trump, we're going to have to live in this for the next 4 years.
We're going to have to live in this for the next 4 years at least. And then the question that came to my mind is, after Donald Trump's presidency, has the Republican Party now become inextricably tied to Donald Trump, the ideology, the persona, or in the public's mind, has conservatism been tied to Donald Trump? I think that's something that remains to be seen going forward. And I also think that what this Donald Trump's presidency, his campaign, now his presidency, has provided is for all of the latent hostility amongst secular progressivism to rise to the surface and to become overt. And to become, if you know, you are now the target of invectives unless you embrace the, you know, politically correct mainstream ideology of the day. And I, you know, I think, you know, buckle up. We're in for a bumpy ride.
Well, so, Fred, I this is unfair to ask you. It'd be unfair, really, at this point to ask anybody, you know, a professor at, you know, of political science at Harvard. But do you have a sense of, just want to address the first thing that Abe brought up, is Donald Trump going to be a one-off? Is he just a unique individual for a unique moment for conservatism? Or does he change conservatism permanently?
Well, it's going to depend, I think, a whole lot on his economic plan, because we're living in a world right now where, you know, if I have a job, I'm happy. If I don't, I'm unhappy.
Right.
So is Donald Trump's economic plan going to work? If you 4 years from now have an unemployment rate that's extremely low, that people, and I guess I'm going to what he has promised.
Right.
He has promised jobs, good paying jobs. He has addressed the issue of the problems in our inner cities.
Yes.
Are we going to see, to be very practical in examples, are we going to see a big drop in the number of murders in Chicago?
Right.
Is he going to be able to put that out there? Is he going to be able to go across many states in America and say, look how far the unemployment rate has fallen? If you've got all of that in place 4 years from now, then his voter base is going to have increased dramatically. How do you vote against that?
Right.
How do you find people, whether it's Ohio, whether it's Pennsylvania, North Carolina, and even some of those New York, Pennsylvania, all up in there, if people are employed and bringing home a good salary, you're in a good mood.
Right.
So it's going to depend on his economic policies for the most part. Now, for we as Christians, as conservative Christians, we may have a different viewpoint on things 4 years from now if, for instance, he has done nothing about the homosexual agenda.
Right.
If Christians are still losing their jobs because they take a stand like the Kleins in Oregon. If there's been no dent in abortions in this country, if he does not go ahead with his promise and pick conservative justices for the Supreme Court, if all of those things don't happen, then that group of evangelical conservative Christians who supported him largely in this election, the question will be, what are you going to do now? Now we're 4 years into Donald Trump. You helped put him in office, but he has failed on those matters, spiritual matters that are important to us. What is going to happen to that voting bloc?
Well, that's it. That's interesting. And I do agree with your assessment in terms of the conservative movement. And let me just say at the outset, I think that probably people across every part of the political spectrum understand that Washington's broken. The way things have been going for the last 40, 50 years is broken. If he can come in and make sweeping changes, drain the swamp somewhat, you never can drain the swamp totally when it comes to a bloated bureaucratic government. You just can't. But if he's able to, start fixing our infrastructure, do those things you said, I think that a lot of people will look at him as being, this is the way we want government to work. And I would put bipartisanship in that as well. They're going to have people on the Democratic side saying, look, we want things done, so we want you to set some of this aside. But in terms of the Christian community, if he turns out to be a pragmatic conservative who only wants to get things done on the fiscal side, and let's say the foreign policy side's a toss-up, but he abandons really the social issues, then you're right. Christians, evangelical Christians, for whom those social issues are very important, that becomes a very difficult spot for them to be in.
Yep.
Abe, I mean, this is we're talking about. This was one of the worries with Donald Trump when he started, when he appeared to be unbeatable on the Republican side. Social conservatives are going, well, what if this guy is a wolf in sheep's clothing? What if he's promising things, but what if he can win without us? Was one of the things I heard kicked around. You know, what happens when a Republican can win without social conservatives? Where do we go? You know, this is a concern. Always a concern because these issues are so important to us.
Well, and to that, I would say that there's some people who much smarter than me who've parsed these numbers, but it's popularly been discussed that Donald Trump won 81% of the evangelical Christian vote, where the evangelical Christians represent a total of about 26% of the national presidential electorate in terms of people who've actually voted.
Right.
Well, amongst every other demographic, Hillary Clinton won 59% of every other demographic. Hmm. So this last election has shown for certain with the current tilt that the country has taken, the Republican nominee would not have been able to win without the evangelical Christian vote. Mm-hmm. So
and without a huge turnout.
And without a huge turnout. Those two factors literally pushed Donald Trump across the line. So should President Trump turn away from that group, it stands to reason he risks being a one-term president. So that is why I believe it's important for the Christian community not to go to sleep now. I think just as important, if not more so than the election, Donald Trump needs to feel the weight of the Christian community kind of peering over his shoulder like an ever-present big brother, saying, now remember, and
you dance with who brung you.
You dance with who brung you. How did you get here again? Mm-hmm. You know, And I think that's going to be necessary because history has shown us quite often that Christians sometimes have a tendency to kind of ease off the gas pedal a little bit and say, oh, now we're here. Everybody back as you were, so to speak. Well, we cannot afford to do that. And he needs to hear from the Christians in the country.
And it's going to happen very quickly because he is promising to put forward his first Supreme Court nominee within the next couple of weeks. He has said that. So a lot of, you know, we're anxious to see.
Right.
We're anxious to see. Now, he's gone through the
Federalist Society.
Society and conservatives.
They're connected to Heritage Foundation, aren't they?
Yeah, they're kind of excited about that. And he said he's only looking at those, what has he got, 20 or so that I think he's been looking at?
I think the list for this first Supreme Court justice is maybe even smaller. He may be down to—
He's down to four,
yeah.
I think, is what I've heard. And so we're going to have to wait and see. And Christians, as to Abe's point, are going to have to vet.
Yeah,
we're going to have a look and make sure. And, you know, if someone pops up, they may be okay in this area of the law. But if they're weak in another area of the law, then we're going to have to speak up and say, no, that's not why we helped you get elected.
Right. And we do have some serious issues that are still kind of on the table. The ultimate fate of Roe v. Wade is always hanging there in the background. Mm-hmm. Huge issue for evangelical Christians, and not just the evangelical Christian community. You know, practicing and believing Catholics, conservative Catholics, others. That's still a very, very important issue. But the even though the same-sex marriage ruling, the Obergefell decision in 2015, you know, appears to have settled that issue. For the time being, there is still the issue of religious liberty when it conflicts with sexual liberty, and then the transgender issue. Mm-hmm. Those are all those three issues are still on. And I would actually add that you, even though I don't think we'll have the same problems with the Department of Health and Human Services, you do have the question of the freedom of Christian groups, Christian colleges, when it comes to abortifacients and all those kind of things. Those are still incredibly important issues for evangelical social conservatives. The one good thing I think we have in our favor is, going to your point, Abe, and Fred, get your take here just before the break, but Trump does have good, solid Christians around him for consultation.
And I think that is one of the jewels in all of this is going to be Vice President-elect Pence. He is an outspoken, unapologetic evangelical Christian. He speaks for his Lord and Savior, Jesus Christ, whenever he can. And that's encouraging. I mean, he's the one next to the president.
Right.
And he was just on. He did a press briefing this morning, and Trump put him in charge of the transition, the whole transition team. So that's how much he respects him.
Right.
And I think Pence brings in also people like Dr. Robert Jeffress and others into that camp. And Trump was willing to listen during the election campaign. And again, that's going to be the test. How close he keeps that element, I'm talking about Donald Trump here, how close he keeps that element to him. Does he still respect their opinion on important matters? So there's a lot to be watching for in these coming weeks and months as we get into the Trump team in the White House. What's he going to do with the power that he's been given?
Well, we certainly know this, that had Hillary Clinton won, and we speak about her as a secular progressive, not simply as a Democrat, but if the secular progressives had been in charge of the White House and the executive branch and all those regulatory agencies, we would be facing a far different world. So that was a great discussion. Big moment tomorrow for the country and for conservatives and for social conservatives. And, of course, we will continue to watch what is happening and report back from a Christian perspective about what happens in the weeks to come. You are listening to Today's Issues here on American Family Radio and American Family Talk, and we will be back after a short break, and we will be discussing with Fred some of the other important incidents and events and news stories that have been happening. We'll be back in a few minutes.
King of the Wild Frontier.
The music's free. I know.
We call it Learning University.
Of necessity.
Trivia Friday.
True.
Ding, ding, ding,
yes.
ding, ding.
Yes. Oh, really?
That's correct. Giraffes do not have vocal cords.
So you want a cheeseburger without cheese?
Hold the cheese.
I said, yes, ma'am, whatever you call it.
Take a break with Tim Wildman and the gang. Friday mornings at 10 Central on American Family Radio.
Hey, do you want to go on a vacation with a purpose? Hello, everyone. I'm Tim Wildman, president of the American Family Association and American Family Radio. A lot of people love to go to the beach. I'm one of them. How about the mountains? Yeah, a lot of folks are raising their hand right now when I say the mountains. Well, this year, why don't you go with us on a spiritual heritage tour of Washington, D.C. and Mount Vernon and have a vacation with an educational and a spiritual purpose. If you'd like to go with us in June or September to D.C. and Mount Vernon, or our separate tour to Williamsburg, Jamestown, and Yorktown, we'd love to have you join us. Just find out all the information at spiritualheritagetours.com. Stephen McDowell of the Providence Foundation will join us as our historian, and he'll be commenting all along the way on our rich Christian heritage here in the U.S. We hope you can join us, spiritualheritagetours.com.
From Washington, I'm Todd Stearns with this Fox News and Commentary next. Good morning from our nation's capital, where final preparations are underway for tomorrow's inauguration. But the big story here continues to be President Obama's decision to commute the sentence of Army Private Chelsea Manning. The president addressed the issue at his last official press conference. He said Private Manning had already served a tough sentence, and he believed justice has been served. But there's growing bipartisan outrage and opposition. Defense Secretary Ash Carter advised the president against commuting Manning, as did a number of top Army officers. And Vice President-elect Mike Pence called the commutation a mistake. He said Manning is a traitor who compromised our national security. It's unclear what, if anything, a President Trump can do, but it's clear the incoming president will not be so generous to future transgender traitors. From Washington, I'm Todd Stearns.
This is Today's Issues. Email your comments to comments@afr.net. Past broadcasts of Today's Issues are available for listening and viewing in the archive at afr.net. Now, back to more of Today's Issues.
And welcome back. Ed Vitagliano sitting in for Tim Wildman today. I'm joined in studio by Fred Jackson, who's news director for American Family News and One News Now, and Abe Hamilton, our public policy analyst. Fred, what's some of the latest things that have been going on?
Well, yesterday I was able to listen to a lot of President Barack Obama's final newscast, our final news conference at the press room there in the White House. And, you know, he started off by thanking the journalists in the room for a great job, he said, that you have done over the last 8 years. You know, you gave me some tough questions, and I was thinking to myself, I can't remember any tough questions other than maybe a Fox News reporter every now and then. And, you know, he would get a stare down from the president on any kind of tough question. But, you know, this love affair with the media just continued yesterday. And the last question went to a reporter that covered him when he was a senator. He made note of this yesterday. And she said, I just want to thank you, Mr. President. It has been an honor to be serving, and I said, to serving with him?
Yes.
What are you going to say at this point? And, of course, the last question was a real softball about something. But after he did his adoration for the media thing, he was asked about, okay, what happens now? What do you think the situation in the country, and what are kind of the things that you're going to be working on when you come back from Palm Springs? And he said, you know, I want to spend some time with the kids and Michelle and write a book and do all that kind of stuff. But then he said, I have some concerns. And it has to do with, he says, the issue of voting rights in this country. He says there are still people who are being denied the right to vote in this country. And he says, I don't care. He says, it goes back to Jim Crow. It goes back to that. And he says the attempts that have been made, the laws that have been attempted to be passed, and some have, dealing with voter fraud. He said there is no voter fraud. He says, any talk of voter fraud in this country is, his words, fake news.
Well, those are two words we're going to hear a lot
over
the next year or two until people get sick of it. But
yeah.
Fake news from Trump as well as from the other side.
But what he was saying, he says there's no such thing as voter fraud. The problem with voting, he says, is that people who have the legitimate right to vote are not getting that opportunity. Well, one of the people we went to yesterday to talk to about this is Kathy Adams, and she's a national board member of Eagle Forum. And she, what is he talking about? I mean, there are cataloged events of people who have voted twice. There is the question, the serious question of people who have entered this country illegally voting.
Right.
There is all of that. But also, the declaration that there's no voter fraud, she points out, and others were able to point out fairly quickly too, wait a minute, you just accused the Russians of being involved with the past election. Your own Democrats are saying Hillary Clinton lost because the Russians were involved and they hacked into our computers and et cetera, et cetera. And you're all concerned. In fact, you got rid of a bunch of Russian diplomats. You sent them home because you said they interfered with our election. And yet you're standing up there and you're saying there's no such thing as voter fraud. So he was taken to task for that. But that was the one kind of heated point in his discussion that he got very passionate about. And I think it goes to what one of his plans are when he leaves office. He's going to be getting together with Eric Holder, who's a former attorney general, and they have both stated they want to deal with redistricting. He said there are voting districts in this country where you have 90% Republican here and you have 90% Democrat over here, and we've got to do something about this. And I think that's a question for Abe. Can Eric Holder and former President Barack Obama in a day or so, can they actually go out there on a campaign and change voting districts in this country?
Well, what they're going to have to do, redistricting happens every 10 years after the national census. So 2010, there was a census. 2000, there was a census. The next census will come up in 2020, okay? Congressional districts are, should I say, congressional representatives are allocated based on populations. So it takes into consideration population shifts in different areas. One notable one is obviously following 2005, after Hurricane Katrina, a lot of people left Louisiana and moved to other places around the country. Mm. So the way that they would have to go about doing so would be to lobby and to prevail, if you will, upon state legislators. Congressional districts are shaped, maps are drawn in the state legislatures across the country. Congress has oversight in terms of, you know, civil rights legislation and things of that nature, but the main source of congressional map configurations are the state legislatures across the country. So if they plan to do that, they would have to go on political campaigns to get state legislators and governors to say, listen, these people need to be more adequately represented. We need to change the map in these types of ways. But again, all of that assumes that the former president, soon to be former president, will be effective in prevailing on the wills of the state representatives.
Well, and it's sometimes a very complex issue. Now, there in a lot of states, especially around big cities, the states have drawn, because of the past and you know, the very real problem of denying voting rights and representation to minority communities, especially the Black community in our country, that sometimes entire districts have been drawn to make sure that a Black representative comes from there.
Yep.
The problem is it limits the number of Black representatives in a state because they all come from all Black districts. So how would they correct that? If they think that that's wrong, how would they correct that without risking losing that one Black representative from that all-Black district? In other words, if they redrew the districts to where a bunch of districts had 30% Black population, they run the risk of it always being a white candidate mm-hmm. from all districts rather mm-hmm. than how would they solve that?
Well, let's just be clear about one thing. Their goal will not be to reduce the numbers of completely black congressional districts in the country. That's not going to happen. Mm. What they're going to try to do is to repeat, if you can recall, what happened to former Congressman Alan West in Florida. If you can recall, Alan West obviously was in Congress. What happened in Florida is that they redrew the congressional district that Alan West represented formerly, that had a lot of Republicans, and to carve out just a piece of that district and add it into one that is overwhelmingly populated by Democrats.
Yeah, and he lost his seat.
And he lost his seat because it forced him to run for re-election against a Democrat in an overwhelmingly Democrat congressional district.
Right.
So their goal is to repeat the Alan West project in other states across the country. That's what they're going to try to do.
Now, if the states don't do what they want, they being Eric Holder and Barack Obama, then they can go to court, correct? Because do the federal courts have then the right to say, no, this doesn't look good to us. This mix what you state what a particular state did, and can overturn what the state has decided a district should be.
Well, what ultimately, unfortunately, all of this stuff ends up in court. Technically, if you're going to strict referring to the Constitution, they shouldn't be able to do it, but the courts probably will weigh in. But the challenge for the courts will be, if the state resists what President Obama and Eric Holder try to do and maintain what already exists, it will be a very difficult burden for President Obama to overcome, in order to, because it's going to say, this is how it has been. What is the imminent necessity to change it to what you want it to be?
You have to prove that something's been done improperly.
Exactly.
Or based on discrimination.
Exactly. As opposed to the districts being redrawn. And so the people that are in the state legislatures will more than likely have to make their arguments to keep the districts the way they are. Or if they change it, the change is something that could possibly be subject to litigation, as opposed to rejecting proposed changes and maintaining the districts as they are.
So the courts would be looking at civil rights laws? Is that what they would use? Is that the tool they would use?
Yes, ultimately. Right. Ultimately, they would look to, should there be a plan that is adopted that changed congressional districts, then the courts will be looking to civil rights laws, precedent, population demographics.
So, for example, if a Republican-controlled legislature in State X, you know, looks at a big city that is a Democratic district mm-hmm. from which usually a black legislator, congressman or congresswoman comes from it. Mm-hmm. And if they broke up that district into five pieces so that now the black community is split up in five districts and now they lose their congressional representation, that would be an instance in which a court might say, no, you are purposefully disenfranchising those black voters
yes.
by splitting them up so that they can't get. So that would be an
yes.
instance in which a state action might be viewed as being unconstitutional.
Right. That's exactly right.
Okay.
And a part of the whole redistricting process, as it originally was configured, the thing that should drive it is population, not ethnic makeup of a
right.
particular locale. But the whole concept of gerrymandering came from the manufacturing of districts to create congressional districts where you have.
Yeah, that ship has sailed.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it's in terms of saying, listen, we're not doing this because we want to disenfranchise minorities.
Mm-hmm.
We're doing this because of X, Y, and Z. That ship has sailed. The kind of automatic viewpoint there on face value, prima facie, whatever,
yeah.
Is that if minorities lose out, it's because of racism, and you know, you have evil motives. So you're never going to be able to do that and say, look, no, we weren't looking at race, or we weren't looking at minority status. That ship is sailed, at least for the time being. Well, just one other thing before we go to another news story. This whole idea, Abe, I'm going to ask you because you're the legal eagle here, of voting voting rights. Mm-hmm. Okay, because that is obviously, as you said, Fred, that is going to be one of the concerns of, well, it'll be, you know, former President Obama and Eric Holder, the former AG, will be at the issue of trying to prevent voter fraud. Mm-hmm. I'm not quite sure I've ever understood. Maybe you can explain it to me. What is the argument? You know, because most of these are just simply laws saying you've got to, you know, you've got to show an ID if you want to vote. You've got to prove you are not only in your district, but that you are a citizen and blah, 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 blah. I'm not sure I understand why that is viewed as an attempt. You're freely admitting that there, under Jim Crow, there were, that's a stain on our nation's history. And there were very real attempts to keep blacks from voting. In the South, but today in 2017, why is it considered? Because that's the way President Obama is viewing these efforts. It's Jim Crow trying to raise its ugly head again. How is it that is seen as Jim Crow when it seems, when you have to, if you want to buy alcohol, you have to show an ID to prove you're over 18.
This is another example of, and I refer to this quote from Thomas Sowell quite often, when Thomas Sowell says, it's not that Johnny the economist who just retired, unfortunately.
Yeah.
But he said, it's not that Johnny can't read. It's not that Johnny can't think. It is that Johnny doesn't know what thinking is. He confuses thinking with feeling.
Hmm.
This is another example of drawing on some of the dark portions of America's history, America's past, to advocate for a political agenda. So the arguments, and it is very difficult for me to communicate this effectively because it's baloney. All right. It's complete baloney. And it's another example of the soft bigotry of low expectations. The argument goes, well, you know, there are lots of older Black Americans who don't have transportation, who can't get voter ID, who don't know how to use the internet, who don't know where the local DMV is. And so it's another unnecessary burden on their right to be franchised and to participate in our electoral process. It's a discriminatory device used to keep Black people from being able to vote. When the facts are, you need ID, as you said, to buy alcohol. You need ID to open a bank account. You need ID
to cash a check.
To do, I mean, almost everything in our society. So why is it considered discriminatory to require an identification to vote? Yeah. Well, because the goal here, ladies and gentlemen, has nothing to do with Black people. Because the statistics show where voter ID is required, the percentage of Black voter participation skyrockets.
Is that right?
That's absolutely factually demonstrable.
That's fascinating.
Especially, for example, when you look in the 2012 election, where you have states where they had voter ID laws on the books that were challenged thereafter, you had more Black voter participation than
as
afterwards.
As a percentage?
As a percentage of the electorate. So it is a Trojan horse, if you will, to lay the foundation to continue to allow undocumented illegal aliens to participate in the electoral process. Yeah. The goal of that entire agenda is to continue to bolster the numbers of illegal aliens who vote.
Yeah.
That's the bottom line,
which
is why you see the most vehement challenges to voter ID laws take place in states that just happen to be close to the southern border, like Texas, like New Mexico, like Arizona, and like California.
Yeah.
And so it's a Trojan horse that's used for no other purpose than to try to attempt to get additional red states to turn blue by including more undocumented illegal aliens to participate in those voting processes so that the Democrats can do, unfortunately, to the Hispanic community what they have done in Black communities to say, hey, we're for you. We support you. We'll give you all of the government handouts that you want while expecting political allegiance long term. And they're attempting to do that same thing to the Hispanic community in America by being the champion
to
voting rights.
Dinesh D'Souza's documentary was about there that came out several months ago.
Hillary's America, was that it?
Hillary's America. But to Abe's point, what's really interesting, where states have brought in these voter ID laws, one of the things that they've done in several jurisdictions, we'll go and pick you up at your house.
Yeah.
If you don't have a drive, mm-hmm. we'll go and pick you up. We'll our expense, government expense, we'll go pick you up. We'll take you down here. And you just have to prove that you're a citizen, a permanent resident of the United States. We'll take your picture uh-huh. and take you home. We'll do that
which
for
is,
you.
It, which is admirable if yeah. they do that for Democrats and Republicans.
It, yes.
It's for whoever needs to get identification.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's all.
Yeah. It infuriates me because what you're saying is that black people are too incompetent to know how to get an ID.
Yeah.
That black people don't know how to use the internet. Black people don't know how to get to a library. Black people don't know how to get to a DMV. And it's the same party, coincidentally, not so coincidentally, that happened to be the same party of Jim Crow and slavery right. in the first place.
Yeah.
That's right.
It makes me angry, and I'm trying very hard to keep my composure.
Well, we can tell. You're doing a great job because keeping your composure.
We better switch topics.
Yes,
here.
Switch topics.
Let's go to journalism.
We are on Facebook Live, so we don't want to see Abe's head blow off. So.
Yeah. Well, as I was saying, this love affair was very obvious yesterday between President Barack Obama and the journalists in the room there. But on top of that, we had some statements made yesterday by the head of CNN. His name is Jeff Zucker. Yeah. And the headline is this, CNN president attacks Trump's attempts to, quote, delegitimize journalism. All right. So that was his statement. It says the incoming U.S. commander-in-chief is trying to delegitimize journalism. And he says it's just unfortunate that the most powerful person in the world is trying to delegitimize journalism and an organization that plays such a vital role in our democracy. I think he's entitled to his opinion, but it's, to use one of his favorite words, sad. Well, stop and think for a moment. Here's the reality. Journalists have delegitimized themselves.
Right.
And if
long before Trump... Yes. said fake news, you're fake news, to a CNN reporter last week.
Yes, it goes well beyond that. Everybody knows. I mean, just looking at the journalism that we have witnessed over the last 18 months, the election campaign, and then since Election Day, it has been attack Trump, attack Trump, attack Trump. No matter what he says, no matter what he doesn't say, it all comes off as negative news. And what really burns these people is, he's not going to play the game the way we want it.
Right.
He's not going to. He ought to be showing us deference. He ought to be respecting us. You know, we are here for the people. Well, have you looked at the polls lately about how the people feel about journalists?
Yes.
Abe, I'm very sorry to say I'm a journalist. Mm-hmm. We're right down there at the bottom. Lawyers and journalists are right at the bottom of how people feel about individuals.
They're
I don't know what you're talking about, Fred.
Journalists and lawyers are right there in the gutter, frankly, where they belong.
But what's burning these people, what's burning these journalists, is that you're now going to have a president, especially in light of what we learned this week. Remember, the president offered to put the journalists, the White House journalists, across the street somewhere in a bigger room, so that more could come to the party and be part of the daily press briefing. And the Correspondent Association went ballistic over that. No, we want to be in the West Wing. And so...
Incidentally, with a smaller press corps.
Oh!
A smaller and more tightly controlled press corps, rather than letting online, quote unquote, journalists, which yeah. print journalists just can't stand, and yeah. television journalists. So we don't want to let the great unwashed masses coming in. Certainly wouldn't want somebody from One News Now allowed in. So
well, and this is to your point. This is something a lot of the public are not aware of. The Correspondents Association decides who gets in the room,
right,
to ask the questions. They decide, for instance, when the party conventions come up, that group decides, is put in charge of credentials for journalists. So they decide who goes. For instance, if you don't have a national presence out there, you're going to be restricted as to where you can go. It's not the political party. It's the journalists they've been given great power. And Donald Trump, to their point the other day, said, okay, we'll let you come back across the street. Now, this room only holds about 29 journalists. but we're going to have a say in who comes into the room.
How would that happen? Can the White House deny credentials that the Correspondents Association wants to grant?
Well, that's
and
what,
vice versa.
That's what Sean Spicer, the Donald Trump's press individual, and that's what apparently Donald Trump is saying. And maybe they're going to pick names out of a jar and saying, today, here's the 29 that get in the room to get to ask the questions. That's what these people are upset about. These are the powerful people, the CNNs, the ABCs, the CBSs, the NBCs.
Fox News.
PBS, yeah. All of those people. They've enjoyed literally the front row for years. And now they're saying he may take that away from us to allow a internet news agency to come in and ask some questions.
Right.
Someone who only does news on Twitter, you know, yeah. Something of that nature. And this has got these journalists upset.
You know, Abe, you know, of course, having a free press is instrumental to having a viable democracy or republic like ours. But the expectation, I think, on the part of the founding fathers was that free press would be a watchdog mm-hmm. over the goings-on inside the government, not a lapdog.
Right.
And this is part of the problem. So this does get a little tricky. You want to have a free press, and so they've got to have access to decision-makers. But the irresponsibility on the part of the mainstream media really has created problems for themselves that they could have avoided had they done their jobs.
Absolutely. And to that, I always resort to Patrick Henry's quote that in order for liberty to be enjoyed, the people that are governed by leaders must be aware of what it is their leaders are doing. So and he says, concludes by saying, otherwise, freedom is nothing more than an illusion. So we need a neutral and objective press. But as you stated, a lot of this is self-inflicted wounds because the press has become so one-sided, and that one-sidedness was revealed to the American people at most recently in the latest election cycle.
Yeah.
Well, and the hacked emails mm-hmm. for Hillary Clinton and the DNC, that is a prime example in my mind that whoever hacked the DNC and got a hold of these emails and publicized them through WikiLeaks, and that went on for days and days and even weeks, really – the media should have been accessing those on both sides and finding and, you know, through freedom of information requests. But because they didn't, it was a shock when these things were released. And then the media complained that this so-called outside force, they said it's Russia, actually did this.
Well, and don't buy into the nonsense from Mr. Zucker, what he had to say yesterday. The discrediting of the media did not start with Donald Trump.
Right.
It didn't. It's been going on for the last, I'd say, 10 years. And that is why along comes the Fox News.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden, they give conservatives a voice. And all of a sudden, the ratings for Fox News through the roof, they're beating everybody else to the point that NBC and CBS and ABC have had to lay off people. Because their revenue, their ad revenue is going down because it's based on population size, viewership, et cetera, et cetera. And so Fox News has proven there's a conservative voice out there and we're not going to ridicule it all the time. And that's how people reacted to that. They say that's the kind of news that we want. Well, we tried to do One News Now and American Family News. You will hear quotes from President Barack Obama and the Democrats.
Right.
But then we provide analysis to that through a biblical point of view.
Amen. Fred Jackson, News Director for American Family News and One News Now. Thank you, Fred, so much for your insights and keeping us up to date on the latest news.
Thank you.
Folks, we're going to take a five-minute break for news. This is Today's Issues. Ed Vitagliano and Abe Hamilton will return as your host. Steve Jordahl will have more of what's happening now. 5 minutes, we'll be back. Please join us.
The views and opinions expressed in this broadcast do not necessarily reflect those of the American Family Association or American Family Radio.